We spoke to Jonathan Drury a few weeks ago about his latest book, Around the World in 80 Plants. His specialty, if you can describe something as broad-ranging as a specialty, is public and not-for-profit scientific, educational, environmental organisations, their engagement and outreach. He is a former trustee of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, and it is his interest in plants that has led to his latest bestsellers and to our desire to talk to him on an ongoing basis. Jonathan's in Dorset. He's with me now. Hi, welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me, Kim.
Pleasure. Never really sure I want to hear about the sophisticated sensory systems of plants on account of the fact that I eat them. But OK, let's hear about tomatoes. You wrote about tomatoes in terms of chemical defences, I think, in Around the World in 80 Plants. Now, a study from Brazil says that if an insect is eating the fruit, electrical signals alert the rest of the plant, which is pretty interesting and slightly unnerving.
Well, it's interesting you use the word unnerving because, of course, you know, that's how our nerves work, isn't it, with electrical signals. And we've known for about 150 years, actually, since about the time of Darwin, that plants do send electrical signals around themselves to convey information. So the first experiments were done on Venus flytraps, you know, those things with the clamp thing that shuts on unlucky insects when they walk across the hairs. But it's only recently that we've really sort of discovered the extent of electrical signaling in plants. And this bit of research that you mentioned in Brazil is new because it's the first time, I think, that they've shown that fruits and tomatoes actually count as fruit rather than vegetables, that fruits also signal in this way.
And in terms of what can be done with this knowledge, any ideas?
Well, the more we understand plants, the more we're able to sort of live alongside them and make the best use of them and give them the easiest lives that we can. So, you know, if we know that certain fungi, for example, interfere with that electrical signaling before there's any other symptoms of plant disease, then you can sort of find out before the plant looks unhealthy whether it might need a bit of attention or some help in some way. So actually, there are quite a lot of applications. But the plant is, you know, when the plant is either wounded or it's too hot or too cold or is under attack from insects, then it sends these signals around, which of course are much quicker. Electrical signals are much quicker than diffusion of sort of hormones and things around the plant would be. So these things can happen in seconds rather than minutes or hours.
And so it would give us a warning that the plant is not feeling very well, and we would try to make it feel better.
Well, you know, we might do those sort of tests, but you know, the more we understand about plants generally, the better that we can, you know, the higher our crop yields, the better that we can treat the environment and so on. So it's all useful knowledge.
If this kind of electrical signal in response to a predator prompts the plant to produce, I don't know, hydrogen peroxide, would we notice that if we ate it? In other words, if the plant does that, does it harm us at all?
No, the thing about hydrogen peroxide is that it's a very reactive chemical. You know, that's why it bleaches your hair. And the, you know, so before we've had a chance to put it in our mouths, it would have reacted with parts of the plant or with things that are trying to eat the plant. So what plants sometimes do is they make a poison like hydrogen peroxide that actually destroys bits of the plant, a bit like the way a submarine captain might close off bits of the submarine if they get damaged and water is rushing in. Mm. In the same way, the plant will sort of sequester the damage and then form a dead layer around it by actually sort of poisoning itself. It's quite a clever thing. But then, of course, it also makes chemicals that insects don't like. And sometimes it makes chemicals that insects do like, but they're the insects that are the predators of the things that's trying to eat them. It's all very sophisticated.
Wow, that's clever, isn't it?
That really is. I remember I gave a talk for GCHQ once, which is our sort of government communications secret place. And the room went very quiet when I talked about, attracting your predator's predator.
Yeah, the enemy of your enemy is your friend, as it were.
Well, that's it. That's it. And tomatoes, I mean, tomatoes are such very, very strange fruit. They're a member of the Solanum family, along with potatoes and mandrakes and deadly nightshade and tobacco and all these kind of rather poisonous things. And the way they release their pollen is when a bumblebee comes along and clamps themselves onto the flower and raises their wing beat to a middle C and vibrates the pollen. It's called buzz pollination, funnily enough. And then, people have known about that for a while, but here's the amazing new thing that has only been known for a short while. Scientists in Korea have discovered that if you play green tomatoes a really loud whistle, which is about a high C, sort of something like this, like that, then you can delay the ripening for about a week by playing 6 hours worth of that lovely sound. And it seems to interfere with the chemical production of the sort of ripening chemical called ethylene that normally makes tomatoes ripen. Isn't
That's
that fantastic?
crazy. Why do you think that would be? How do you think that would work?
Well, it works by sort of modulating the what's called the gene expression, the way that the genetic information of the plant is converted into actual sort of behavior. So, but why it should work that way, why plants should be particularly sensitive to vibration? Well, I can see why it would be with a bumblebee because the plant is getting pollination in return. But why it should be an advantage to have a hi-fi playing a loud note beats me. And I think it's probably just a side effect of something else. So it's not something that it's evolved as an advantage, but it's just that's the way that the sort of plant chemicals work.
So more and more it does seem as if it's not so crazy to talk to plants as Prince Charles famously did.
Well, exactly. Back in the 1980s, everyone sort of hooted at Prince Charles for talking to plants, and I think that what he was really getting at the time was not literally talking to plants, but just being sympathetic to plants' lives, which I think would actually, I think we all realise would be a lot better for humanity if we did that. But it is true that there are plants that really do respond to sounds, and in fact, there are plants that modulate the content of their nectar according to what insect is nearby by sensing the pattern of the wing beats. So a moth or a butterfly needs a very different collection of amino acids and sugars to a bee, for example, and it'll change the concentration of those chemicals accordingly. It's extraordinary.
Spookily smart. Somebody's drawn my attention to a meme going round at the moment. Plants are actually farming us by giving us oxygen daily until we all eventually decompose so they can consume us.
Do you know, if you looked at the world from a plant's point of view, you'd just think grasses have been so fantastically successful. They've manipulated us not just into sort of felling forests and planting golf courses, but all these cereals that we eat, the wheat, the corn, all these other things here, rice and so on. These are all grasses, and I think it's. You could look at it from a grass point of view and say, wow, that's a pretty successful organism.
They do say that a weed is just a plant in the wrong place, and our appreciation of biodiversity has led to a new value being accorded to hitherto despised plants. And now the Royal Horticultural Society has given a gold medal to a bunch of weeds, basically, including ragwort, which is a really, really horrible weed that is poisonous to horses, if I remember correctly.
Well, yes, I mean, I think the Royal Horticultural Society and the Campaign for Rural England and these other groups, they've been responsible in a way for rewarding kind of bad behavior in the past. So these best kept village competitions where everyone had to mow every plant within an inch of its life, and anything, any grass longer than about a centimeter was just sort of would have them struck off the list. And now they're realizing that actually these webs of insects and other little critters are incredibly important, not just for them, but for us actually. We're part of all these food webs and so on, and very important to have that biodiversity. And so they're beginning to reward what we used to see as messiness, but now we see as kind of charming biodiversity. With some people call them weeds. They're only weeds if they're in the wrong place, as you said, at the in the wrong species. But what is a weed really? Something that might be a weed in one place, for example, ragwort that you mentioned, it is an invasive species in New Zealand and really shouldn't be in New Zealand. It was by the about the 1930s it had spread to most of both islands. Whereas in England, it's actually an indigenous plant. So then that means that it doesn't spread out of control because it's evolved alongside all the other little insects and things that eat it and keep it in check, fungi and so on. Now, it is poisonous to horses, but horses really hate the taste. Horses are not stupid animals, and I've seen fields around here in the southwest of England, where I am at the moment in Dorset, rural countryside, where you see all the ragwort, which is about chest height, lovely little yellow flowers. They're doing just fine because horses and other cattle just don't eat them at all, whereas the grass has been cut right down by the animals. And I think that the few deaths that there are that are accorded to ragwort poisoning are actually because of other things to do with sort of bad animal welfare or sort of dampness in their feedstuffs if they're not outdoors all the time, where you get molds and so on. And the same tests that you do for ragwort poisoning are actually the same ones for all those other nasty things that they can get. So I think ragwort has a bad rap.
And how did, what was the response to the Royal Horticultural Society giving the gold medal to the Weedy Garden?
Well, I think that it was probably mixed, because I think that for some people, and I was about to say older people who've been brought up with needing to keep nature at bay, I think it was a bit difficult. But actually, I don't think it is just older people. I think that it's people who've one way or another been brought up to feel that nature is untidy. And I don't think that is necessarily age related, but I think more and more people are realizing that biodiversity is to be celebrated, and having some insects and and a variety of plants all sort of jostling together is in its own way just as beautiful, and in my book even more so than having something which is all sort of pristine and separate, and you can see all the soil between each plant kind of thing, which seems to me very unnatural, and something that personally I don't care for so much. But I can see how other people, I think my grandmother, for example, would have felt very sort of, I think she was very superstitious about having nature too close, and I think that that superstition has carried on, and you can see why a few generations ago we were in a battle against nature in order to survive.
A nice lawn, of course, is a beautiful thing, but I've never been a huge fan of them because they're so pernickety and you have to spend so much time and effort and probably pesticides to keep them looking so nice. There is a certain trend in Auckland among, probably, let's face it, more affluent people to put AstroTurf down. Low maintenance, you don't have to spray it and blah, blah, blah. How do you feel about that in yourself?
What do you think I'm going to say? I think that's a disaster, because not only is that the creation of a green desert, but it's also, plastics use really unpleasant chemicals, use a lot of fossil fuels in their manufacture. So you're just doing harm upon harm upon harm. Much better to have a small lawn, just the bit that you need to really sort of sit on, and the rest, you can have a very low maintenance, enjoyable enjoyable space with all sorts of things growing that you don't have to spend lots and lots of effort on. And you know, when you think about what a nice lawn looks like, that's not necessarily a completely uniform green. You know, to my mind, even
Well,
the sort
no.
of
I mean, it's usually covered with large orange circles if you have a dog or a cat. It's lovely to. AstroTurf, however, does not respond that way. Lovely to talk to you, Jonathan Drury.